This is the Africa Debrief by Atlas News. Hello and welcome to the Africa Debrief by Atlas News, where we take an in-depth look at the region's top stories and analyze and explain them to you. In a recent development, Kenya and Haiti signed a security agreement aimed at resolving a months-long saga regarding the deployment of Kenyan police officers to Haiti. This deployment is part of a wider effort to combat the rampant gang violence plaguing the Caribbean nation. The agreement, described as a reciprocal arrangement, is seen as a crucial step towards overcoming a legal hurdle that had previously stalled the deployment. Kenya's High Court had ruled the initial deployment unconstitutional due to the lack of such an agreement between the two countries. This podcast dives into the context of this agreement, the dire situation in Haiti, and the challenges that have delayed the deployment of Kenyan forces. Haiti has been grappling with gang violence for years, but the situation has significantly worsened since the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse in 2021. Prime Minister Ariel Henry, who has assumed leadership since then, has struggled to contain the situation. Gangs have effectively taken control of parts of the capital, Port-au-Prince, leading to widespread fear and disruption. The recent wave of violence in late February, where gangs targeted police stations and civilians, exemplifies the urgency of international support. In July 2023, Kenya stepped forward to lead a multinational police force under the umbrella of the United Nations. This mission for humanity, as Kenyan President William Ruto described it, aims to restore order and pave the way for long-term stability in Haiti. The deployment, funded by the UN with the US as a primary contributor, would see 1,000 Kenyan police officers working alongside forces from other nations like Jamaica and Senegal. Despite initial approval from the UN and the Kenyan Parliament, the deployment faced unexpected delays due to legal challenges. The Kenyan High Court rejected it on multiple occasions, citing concerns about deploying forces outside Kenya without proper legal justification and public participation. While the Parliament addressed the public participation concern through a survey, the lack of a reciprocal agreement with Haiti remained a sticking point. The newly signed agreement between Kenya and Haiti is intended to address this final legal hurdle. It allows for the deployment of Haitian police officers to Kenya under certain circumstances, fulfilling the reciprocity requirement. President Ruto and Prime Minister Henry have expressed hope that this agreement will pave the way for a swift deployment. However, the situation in Haiti remains complex. Prime Minister Henry, facing pressure to hold elections, has postponed them several times, citing the need for restored security first. Skepticism surrounds his latest promise of elections by August 2025. The success of the deployment itself also hinges on various factors, including the cooperation between different police forces and the overall political climate within Haiti. Next, the recent launch of the Economic Freedom Fighters, EFF Manifesto in Gauteng, was marked by controversy as supporters chanted the infamous "Shoot the Boer, Kill the Boer" slogan. This podcast will delve into the history and implications of this chant, exploring its use by the EFF and the ongoing debate surrounding it. The chant, "Kill the Boer," has its roots in the struggle against apartheid, targeting the Afrikaner people who were the dominant force during that oppressive regime. The EFF, a left-wing political party known for its outspoken stance on racial inequality, argues that the chant is a symbolic expression against historical land dispossession. They claim Boer refers not to race, but rather to the system of land ownership that benefited white South Africans during apartheid. The EFF advocates for a radical land reform policy, which includes expropriation without compensation. This policy directly challenges the current land ownership structure, which many see as a legacy of apartheid. Critics argue that the "Kill the Boer" chant fuels violence against white farmers, regardless of their political affiliation or role in the historical injustices. They point to the horrific farm attacks that continue to plague South Africa, often targeting white farmers with extreme brutality. The EFF's use of the chant has been challenged in court. The party argues that it is protected free speech and does not incite violence. However, the chant's association with historical oppression and its presence during some farm attacks raise serious questions. The Shoot the Boer chant remains a potent symbol in South Africa, highlighting the complex and unresolved issues of land ownership, racial reconciliation, and the legacy of apartheid. While the EFF maintains it is a political statement, the chant's association with violence cannot be ignored. Moving forward, South Africa needs open and honest dialogue to address the root causes of land inequality and the ongoing violence against farmers. Now we explore the recent tragedy involving two South African National Defense Force, SANDF soldiers deployed in the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC. This news comes just a month after two other SANDF soldiers were killed by a mortar attack on their base in eastern DRC. Now, two more soldiers have lost their lives in an apparent murder-suicide incident. While the official report does not disclose the names of the soldiers involved, it confirms that one soldier shot and killed the other before taking their own life. Both soldiers were part of the United Nations Organization Stabilization Mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, MONUSCO, working to counter the M23 rebel group in the conflict-ridden eastern region. Dr. Emmanuel Matambo, a professor at the University of Johannesburg, highlights that such incidents are not uncommon in war zones. He points to a similar case in Nigeria earlier this year, where a soldier killed his superior officer. These tragedies underscore a critical issue: the lack of adequate mental health support for soldiers deployed in active conflict zones. The current state of mental health services available to South African troops serving in the DRC under MONUSCO remains unclear. However, a past statement by the former Minister of Defense suggests that SANDF members have access to a range of mental health professionals. This recent incident raises questions about the effectiveness of existing mental health programs within the SANDF, particularly for deployed troops. A thorough investigation by the joint SANDF-MONUSCO Board of Inquiry is crucial. Furthermore, ensuring soldiers have access to quality mental health resources before, during, and after deployment is essential to prevent similar tragedies. Next, we'll delve into the case of Lucas Richards, an American citizen currently on trial in Liberia for attempted murder and aggravated assault. The story raises complex questions about access to medical care, international legal proceedings, and the challenges faced by Americans abroad. Lucas Richards stands accused of attempting to murder his wife, Jessica Lloyd, in Liberia on September 14, 2023. Miss Lloyd alleges Mr. Richards injected her with drugs to terminate her pregnancy and then tried to slit her throat. Thankfully, she survived and is actively involved in the prosecution. Mr. Richards's situation took a concerning turn when his lawyer requested permission for him to travel to the United States for medical treatment. Citing a devastating condition, the details of which remain undisclosed, the defense team argued for Richards's temporary release. However, on February 28, 2024, the Liberian Criminal Court Judge Nelson Chinna denied the request. The judge's decision hinged on the lack of an extradition treaty between Liberia and the United States. Essentially, the court feared Mr. Richards might not return for trial if allowed to leave Liberia. Adding another layer to the story, Creekside Church in Urbandale, Iowa, initially claimed Mr. Richards as a member. However, upon learning the victim was not his American wife Lois, but Liberian wife Jessica Lloyd, the church clarified that Mr. Richards was not actually a member and had founded his own separate church in Liberia. This case presents a tangled web of legal and humanitarian issues. Mr. Richards's right to medical care must be weighed against the court's need to ensure he faces justice. The lack of an extradition treaty further complicates the situation. We'll continue to monitor this case for further developments. In the coming weeks, we'll likely see arguments from both sides, the defense team pushing for medical care access and the prosecution emphasizing the potential flight risk. Next, we're focusing on a troubling development in South Africa, the recent killing of a political party member, and the potential for violence in the upcoming national elections. Vusimuzi Ntuli, a member of the newly formed Umkhonto Wesizwe Party, MK, was shot dead in Umlazi, KwaZulu-Natal, KZN, on Saturday. This has raised concerns about political violence marring the elections scheduled for May 29th, particularly in KZN, a stronghold for the ANC, EFF, and MK parties. This isn't the first time political tensions have boiled over in KZN. In July 2021, the province, along with Gauteng, experienced widespread violence and looting known as the July Unrest. This unrest stemmed from the arrest of Jacob Zuma, now the leader of the MK party, for contempt of court. While the scale of violence seen in 2021 might be unlikely this time around, political killings, especially in KZN, remain a serious concern. Since 2018, there have been 155 political killings investigated in the province, including the murders of 52 councillors. Experts point to several factors contributing to this violence. One is the easy availability of weapons. Allegations of police officers selling or renting firearms to criminals have been an issue for years. Additionally, KZN sits on the so-called AK-47 corridor, a smuggling route stretching from Mozambique to South Africa, which further fuels the proliferation of illegal weapons. These factors make it difficult to solve political killings. Many remain unsolved, which fosters a climate of impunity and emboldens perpetrators. The resurgence of political killings highlights a broader concern: the erosion of the rule of law in South Africa. Jacob Zuma's return to national politics raises additional anxieties. Some fear his presence could reignite ethnic tensions and inter-party violence. These elections, dubbed the most important in 30 years, carry a heavy weight. We'll continue to monitor the situation in KZN as the elections draw closer. Here on the podcast, we'll strive to bring you balanced and informative updates. Next, the U.S. Department of the Treasury recently announced a significant shift in policy, the termination of broad economic sanctions that have been in place on Zimbabwe for a long time. This doesn't mean the U.S. is turning a blind eye to concerns about human rights and corruption in Zimbabwe. Instead, the focus has shifted to targeted sanctions. The Treasury Department is now targeting 11 individuals and 3 entities believed to be involved in continuing corruption and serious human rights abuses. These individuals include prominent figures in Zimbabwean politics and business, like President Emmerson Mnangagwa and businessman Kutakwashe Regimond Tagwire. The sanctions aim to hold these individuals accountable for their actions. The rationale behind this policy change is twofold. First, the U.S. hopes a more targeted approach will be more effective in tackling corruption and human rights abuses. Blanket sanctions, the argument goes, can inadvertently harm ordinary Zimbabweans. This is especially relevant considering the current food insecurity crisis in Zimbabwe, largely caused by drought. Broader sanctions could make it harder to deliver aid to those who need it most. Secondly, the U.S. wants to signal its commitment to supporting the Zimbabwean people. The statement from the National Security Council emphasizes continued support for civil society, human rights defenders, and independent media. However, it remains to be seen if this policy shift will be enough to improve the situation in Zimbabwe. The economic woes the country faces are complex, and it's unclear if targeted sanctions alone can bring about significant economic recovery. Now, we'd also like to discuss some exciting news from East Africa. Somalia has officially joined the East African Community, EAC, becoming the 8th member of this economic and political bloc. This is a significant development for both Somalia and the EAC. Somalia gains access to a wider market, potentially boosting its trade and economic development. The EAC, on the other hand, expands its reach and influence in the region. Somalia's long coastline, strategically located at the crossroads of Africa and the Arabian Peninsula, presents exciting opportunities. The EAC can leverage this strategic asset to tap into Somalia's blue economy, which encompasses fisheries, maritime transport, and tourism. However, the EAC's path to deeper integration isn't without challenges. Internal conflicts between member states, like the ongoing tensions between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo, can create friction. The recent withdrawal of EAC troops from the DRC due to accusations of collusion with rebels is a case in point. This highlights the complexities of undertaking joint security operations within the bloc. Despite these challenges, Somalia's membership is a positive step for the EAC. The potential benefits of increased trade, economic cooperation, and a larger market are significant. Whether the EAC can overcome its internal hurdles and translate this potential into real progress for its members remains to be seen. We'll be following developments closely and keeping you updated. Now, in February 2024, the U.S. Army Security Force Assistance Brigade, USASF, concluded a 3-week training program for 80 Sierra Leonean Armed Forces, RSLAF, soldiers. This initiative aimed to bolster their capabilities in critical site and asset security, encompassing areas like perimeter patrol, securing vital installations, and controlling access points. This training program comes in the wake of a critical security breach last September. Sierra Leone's main ammunition stores in Wilberforce and Freetown were compromised, with weapons stolen and later used in a failed coup attempt on November 26, 2023. The attempted coup involved the release of roughly 2,000 inmates and an attack on a military barracks by unidentified assailants. President Julius Maada Bio declared the attempt unsuccessful, and 12 individuals, including a member of former President Ernest Bai Koroma's security detail, faced treason charges. The U.S. Embassy in Freetown emphasizes the significance of this partnership, highlighting its potential to strengthen Sierra Leone's defensive abilities and promote professionalism, respect for human rights, and democratic values within the RSLF. This cooperation is also seen as contributing to regional security and stability. The United States has a long history of engagement with Sierra Leone, and this training program underscores their commitment to supporting the country's progress in democracy, healthcare, and economic prosperity. The U.S. sees a successful partnership as mutually beneficial. However, the situation in Sierra Leone remains complex. Despite this security cooperation, the country grapples with corruption, scoring a low 35 on Transparency International's Corruption Perception Index, which suggests significant challenges in this area. Looking ahead, it will be interesting to see how this training program translates into improved security practices within the RSLAF. Additionally, continued U.S. support in Sierra Leone's own efforts to address corruption will be crucial factors in ensuring long-term stability in the region. Now we focus on a contentious issue currently being debated in Gambia, the decriminalization of female genital mutilation, FGM. On Thursday, a bill proposed by Almame Gibba was presented to Gambian lawmakers. This bill seeks to remove criminal penalties for FGM, a practice that involves the partial or complete removal of external female genitalia for non-medical reasons. The legislation will be discussed by Parliament later this month. FGM has been illegal in Gambia since 2015, with perpetrators facing up to 3 years in prison. However, the practice remains deeply ingrained in Gambian society, particularly within the Muslim community, which makes up nearly 95% of the population. Here, FGM is often seen as female circumcision and viewed as a crucial religious and cultural tradition. The U.S. Department of State sheds light on the complex social dynamics surrounding FGM in Gambia. Their report highlights the influential role of older women and traditional practitioners who perpetuate the practice. Social pressure also plays a part, with girls sometimes enticed by celebratory events and gifts to undergo the procedure. In some cases, girls are even forced to comply against their will. The report estimates that between 60 to 90% of Gambian women have undergone some form of FGM. Further complicating the issue is a 2023 fatwa issued by the Supreme Islamic Council of Gambia. This official Islamic legal ruling declared FGM to be legal and even a virtue of Islam. This came after an Islamic cleric intervened to pay fines for three women charged with practicing FGM. Gambia's international commitments also present a hurdle for the decriminalization bill. The country is a signatory to the African Union's Maputo Protocol on the Rights of Women. This protocol explicitly calls for the prohibition of FGM and other harmful practices that violate women's human rights. Given these international obligations, it seems unlikely that the decriminalization bill will pass unless Gambia withdraws from the Maputo Protocol. The coming parliamentary debate promises to be a critical juncture for Gambia as it grapples with tradition, human rights, and its place in the international community. We will continue to monitor this developing story. Now, on March 4, 2024, the Nigerian Armed Forces reported a successful counterinsurgency operation in Katsina State. During the operation conducted in Kurfi and Safana Local Government Areas, LGAs, troops reportedly killed four terrorists, including Maikusa, the deputy leader of the region's most prominent terrorist cell. According to a statement by Nigerian Army spokesperson Onyema Nwachukwu, the operation faced resistance from the militants, but the military ultimately prevailed due to superior firepower. The statement also details the recovery of weapons and ammunition, including AK-47 rifles, magazines, and ammunition. Additionally, the military claims to have destroyed terrorist camps in several villages across Kurfi and Safana LGAs. Katsina State, along with other parts of northwest Nigeria, has been plagued by terrorism, often referred to locally as banditry, for nearly a decade. The roots of this violence are complex, involving competition between farmers and herders for resources, as well as the proliferation of illegal weapons. It's important to note that while the Nigerian military has presented this as a significant victory, independent verification of the details is often difficult to obtain in conflict zones. The success of this operation hinges on several factors. Weakening the leadership of a prominent terrorist group could disrupt their organization and activities. However, the long-term effectiveness of this approach depends on addressing the underlying causes of violence in the region. Finally, we are focusing on a dire situation unfolding in Sudan. The World Food Program, WFP, a UN agency, has issued a stark warning, calling the potential hunger crisis in Sudan the world's largest. This crisis doesn't exist in a vacuum. Sudan has grappled with food insecurity for years, with millions displaced even before the current war began in April 2023. This conflict has exacerbated the problem dramatically, displacing an additional 8 million people internally and externally. As a result, Sudan now faces the world's largest internal displacement crisis. The WFP estimates a staggering 18 million people within Sudan are experiencing acute hunger, with 5 million in emergency hunger situations. Tragically, 90% of those facing emergency hunger reside in areas completely inaccessible to aid workers. This means they are receiving no assistance whatsoever. Darfur, a region that experienced a devastating hunger crisis 2 decades ago, is again a hotspot. However, humanitarian efforts are hampered by revoked permissions for cross-border aid deliveries, essentially halting aid flowing from Chad into Darfur. The WFP doesn't explicitly name the authorities responsible, but the vast majority of Darfur is controlled by a paramilitary force opposed to the ruling military junta. The situation is further compounded by the dire state of Sudan's infrastructure and economy. The UN and other international actors warn that the humanitarian crisis is nearing a breaking point, potentially leading to complete collapse. Even in accessible areas, aid organizations lack the resources to meet the immense needs. The capital, Khartoum, has been particularly ravaged by the conflict. Both sides have engaged in heavy fighting within the city, with accusations of indiscriminate civilian bombings. A glimmer of hope emerged on March 6th, when Sudan agreed to allow humanitarian aid deliveries through Chad and South Sudan for the first time. However, the WFP emphasizes that a lasting solution hinges on ending the war. Ultimately, a cessation of hostilities and lasting peace is the only way to reverse course and prevent catastrophe, a WFP statement declared. Unfortunately, peace efforts haven't yielded much progress. Multiple ceasefires have been quickly broken, and mediation attempts have stalled. High-level talks between opposing factions in January yielded little public progress, but marked the first time such officials met directly. The African Union, AU, has also entered the fray, holding talks with Sudan's military leader. While Sudan reportedly expressed confidence in the AU's potential solutions, acceptance is contingent on reinstatement as a full AU member and withdrawal of a paramilitary force from occupied areas. Sudan's suspension from the AU stemmed from a military coup in October 2021, an event the current leader downplays as a dissolution of partnership. The situation in Sudan is complex and deeply troubling. Millions face starvation, and the ongoing conflict fuels the crisis. International efforts to mediate peace and deliver aid are ongoing, but much depends on the willingness of both sides to lay down arms and prioritize the well-being of the Sudanese people. This has been the Africa Debrief by Atlas News.